Thank you. All right, we did it. It's great to have me back. Gentlemen, Heng Zuchov, Machzach Behemish. Now I can tell who speaks Yiddish here, because if you spoke Yiddish, that would be hysterical. This evening's program examines a problem confronting our people. These are not issues of if you feel that your tax dollars that you pay for real estate that goes towards the educational system here in this state. It's not an issue of vouchers. We're not talking about recycling issues. We're not talking about dangers to the caribou in the tundra if new oil pipelines are created. The issue we're going to be dealing with this evening relates to how the Jewish state is slandered by the media. And you should know that the consequences are extraordinary. It's a girl, her name is Nava Applebaum. I figure Nava Applebaum right now should be about 6 months pregnant. She can't fit into her clothes anymore. She's been trying to push it and push it, but she can't anymore. Nava Applebaum right now should probably be on a cordless with her mom. She hasn't been able to eat chicken in 2 weeks. The very thought just makes her want to throw up. She should have spent last night lying next to Hanan. Put your hand over here, Hanan. Feel this. I don't feel anything. No, move your hand over a little bit more. What's that? That's our baby. He's kicking. Or maybe she's kicking. Nava Applebaum is dead. Nava Applebaum was murdered less than 24 hours before her wedding. She was sitting with her father, David Applebaum, a physician and a leading doctor with enormous innovations in emergency room work. Sitting with him in the Hillel Cafe in Yerushalayim, and her father, just flown back from the United States after doing a presentation in America on emergency room in Israel, who was sitting the night before the wedding. Can only imagine the smiles. She hadn't seen her dad in a couple of weeks. You can imagine the intense love that was there, the anticipation that by the next evening that time she'd be a married woman. But she and her father, along with 13 other Jews, were murdered on that horrible day. September 9th. And, of course, the very next day she was buried and her chatan, her soon-to-be groom, simply laid his wedding ring on top of her body. You should understand that when the Guardian, one of the most vicious newspapers in the world that slanders the Jewish state each and every day, when its writers place a pen on a piece of paper, when journalists from the Toronto Star put words down about the Jewish state, you should know that people in the Holy Land die. There was a survey done, which I mentioned to you in the last program, a survey done of 15 European countries. It was an extensive survey. The question was asked of more than 1,000 participants of all the countries in the world. Which nation posed the greatest threat to world peace? So one would imagine that a response would be something like the top countries would go something like North Korea, which is today an enormous threat to the world because it has an advanced nuclear weapons program and almost certainly possesses weapons of mass destruction. One would imagine that the kind of country would be listed would be the Sudan. Whereas we're speaking today, this North African country enslaves black men and women and sells these poor lost souls, murders genocide against Christians only because of their faith. I would think that Iran, one of the most dangerous countries in the world, where freedom does not exist. I would think that Saudi Arabia, a country where women have no rights, where a Christian cannot pray, you cannot build a church there. No synagogue could be built there. When Jewish people fought in the armed forces, both in the first and second Persian Gulf War. And I remember in the first Persian Gulf War, I knew quite a number of the people. I knew a number of the chaplains who went off to Saudi Arabia to fight with the large coalition forces. I remember it was the high holidays. They could not, in Saudi Arabia, even have a synagogue within the army bases that were for U.S. and coalition forces. They had to use infirmaries and laundry rooms and mark them as some sort of Red Cross rooms, and that's where they would pray to God. And here these coalition forces were there to protect the citizens of Saudi Arabia. Because had Saddam willed it, if there would have been no American forces there, certainly all Saddam would have had to do when he was finished with Kuwait is make just one little turn going a little bit west and he would be in the cradle of Islam and take that over as well, along with the largest oil reserves in the world. So you would think that the response would have been these countries. Libya engages, buys the slaves from the. Where are the slaves? Where are they purchased? They go to countries like Libya and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. But if you're looking for demonstrations and tent cities in these countries, in Berkeley and here at Penn State to demonstrate against these countries and calls for divestitures, if you're waiting for the Philadelphia Inquirer to condemn these countries, don't waste your time. It's life and death, guys. I remember I do news talk radio for Israel National Radio, and I remember was a man, his name is Chezi Goldberg, Dr. Yecheskel Goldberg. He did very special programming. His life was devoted to Jewish, particularly Jewish youth who had somehow fallen away, to the lost souls, young men and women who had fallen to drugs and so on. Chezi Goldberg was January 29th. Chezi Goldberg, along with 10 other Jews, were murdered on a bus just a handful of meters away from the Prime Minister's residence. He was a Canadian. He comes from Toronto. In fact, he was a prominent Canadian. Now he's a PhD, which he acquired in Canada. But he also was a member. He was a member of the Canadian Armed Forces, which comes as an enormous surprise to many people who didn't know this such a thing existed. Naturally, when someone, a prominent Canadian, would be murdered, so the family was sitting shiva. They were sitting shiva in an area called Betar Elit. There's a place on earth that you can call utopia. Probably be Betar Elit. Betar Elit is just a few minutes north of Jerusalem. It's a yeshuv that is all devoutly religious Jews. There are devoutly religious Jews who are Ashkenazic, Sephardim, Hasidim, but it's a devoutly religious community. And that's where his family sat shiva for Chezi, who was murdered, father of seven children. So you would think that the ambassador to Canada, Donald Sinclair, would immediately go to the family to visit them, naturally, to give his condolences. But actually, he did not. And the reason he did not is that Betar Elit, in addition to being a deeply religious community in an extraordinary area, it also is just literally a handful of kilometers over the Green Line, meaning it was in an area of the land of Israel that was liberated from the Jordanians in the 1967 war. And as a result of that, Mr. Donald Sinclair would not visit the family. What makes this all very strange is that although the government of Canada will not visit a Jew over the Green Line. Many, many Canadian dignitaries, in fact, his own foreign minister, none of you will know because outside of Canada, nobody knows a thing what goes on in Canada. No one, even in Canada, no one knows what's flying in Canada. So we have a president, a prime minister who's there. No one knows anything. Canada, Canadians have no idea. It's an absolute fact what I'm telling you, you should know. In Canada, they have a holiday. They say, today's a holiday. So yes, and what happened? I don't know. They try it. Anytime. Test me. They have no clue what's going on in Canada. All they know is hockey, and that's it. That's the whole nation. In fact, the Foreign Minister of Canada, Bill Graham, over and over again visited Yasser Arafat in the Mukata in Ramallah. What makes this all strange is that the 24-year-old terrorist who murdered Chesi Goldberg and 10 others was part of his own police force. He was a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organization police force. He received his paycheck from Yasser Arafat. So if we understand what we are confronting today, if we can somehow absorb the difficulty that is facing our nation at this time, you have to understand that although a Canadian foreign minister will visit the one who carries out and calls for the terrorism, they will not visit the family of the victims of the terror. That's what you need to understand. Now, you should know this presentation is very odd. The fact that I would need to present a program on anti-Israel bias in the media is absolutely odd. It's strange. And the reason for that is I would think that Israel would have no greater supporters, that you would not find an area, a discipline, where there is a greater love for Zion than in the media, and in the press, and in the university campuses. The reason is very simple. Your Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, they all consider themselves progressive. They are to the left of center politically. They support left-wing issues and ideas. I don't care where you are on these issues. However, these people believe that in issues like gay rights, they believe in liberal causes. The left believes that men and women should have equal rights regardless of their gender. So I would think that in the state of Israel, which just had a demonstration, a rally, more than 70,000 gays and lesbians. I never sure of the difference there. Gays and lesbians, not just gays. Some of you thought they only let gays in. It's not true at all. They opened it up now to lesbians in addition to that. And their supporters. Are these jokes too advanced for you here? No. Okay. And their supporters, they marched with their purple pajamas, they were running with their lavender outfits, with their Superman capes, with their shmatas, they had flags with all the fancy colors, the lavender all over. And in Tel Aviv, they march every year. The Knesset now boasts a gay lesbian member of the Knesset. In Israel, to be gay is you're a big hit today, to be gay. Israel was the second democracy in the history of the world to produce a prime minister that was a woman. Israel, racism doesn't exist. In the United States, there are civil rights laws, special laws to protect minorities with a history of oppression. They make sense. The fact that civil rights laws apply to black men and women as opposed to Protestant men and women makes all the sense in the world because there is a history in America of oppression. And we know about it. We read. We look back at what happened. Don't have to go too far back and go back to the 50s and what was going on in the South. And we sort of cringe. I can't believe that went on in America. You need it in the United States. Because there's a history of oppression, a history of racism. In Israel, there are no such things as civil rights. There are no special laws that if you go and you commit a crime against someone of color in the Holy Land, that you'll receive an extra penalty for it. It doesn't exist. Why? Because it's unnecessary. Because in Israel, no one would dream of seeing a Jew who's black, whether he comes from North Africa, he comes from Ethiopia, or comes from somewhere in the East, that someone would say, oh, you black man, that's unimaginable. It's unthinkable. In fact, I remember when Israel was bringing in Olim from Ethiopian Jews. They had these flights, the El Al flights, that took off, special flights. I think it was like 1,400 people on a single flight. They couldn't bring anything on. So they received so many benefits. Black Jews from North Africa received such an overwhelming amount of benefits that were provided for them that there were massive demonstrations by Jews from the former Soviet Union that how come they're, you know, these are white Jews. How come the black Jews are getting all the benefits and they're getting anything? So I would think that your Philadelphia Inquirer, every morning, before they even push the power button on their computers, I would think that they would all have to sit in a room, stand in a room, and they all pledge allegiance to the state of Israel. They would sing the HaTikvah together. I would think so. That would be logical, because Israel should be a state, a paradigmical state, where this is the ideal. Your papers here and all the liberal media throughout the United States and around the world is very pro-abortion, pro-rights of women to have an abortion, pro-choice, as it's called. Now, although in Israel black men and women have rights, in Saudi Arabia they don't. In Saudi Arabia, a woman has no rights. A woman certainly can't have an abortion. A woman can't even leave her home without written permission from her husband or a male family member. Woman has no rights at all. Gay in Ramallah, gay, you might as well, you know, that's it. Gay shluffed, you're finished. In the whole Arab world, with the exception of one country, there's not even a democracy. With the exception of France, there's nothing else. How am I doing so far? Not bad. And of course, so in the Arab world, 22 countries has not produced a democracy, has not produced rights for women. It's not even close. It's not like a little more for men than women. It's women have no rights and men have all the rights. Racism, anti-Semitism, religious inequality, it's all, Saudi Arabia epitomizes everything that's wicked in the world. Israel is a completely free society. So you would think that the press would love Israel. You think they would love Israel and they would despise the Sudan with its slave trade. You think they would, you know, in the United Nations with the slave, you know, Israel cannot, to this day, Israel cannot even be in the Security Council. Can't. Can never be. Syria just finished its job in the Security Council. They could be. Why? Because Syria is a member of one of the five major groupings in the United Nations. Israel, and that's thanks to France, is not permitted into any of those five groupings. You'll never see Israel. You'll see Algeria there. You won't see Israel there. In the United Nations, and since the history of the United Nations, there have been 10 emergency sessions in the United Nations. 6 of them pertain to condemning Israel. During the Clinton administration, when more than 800,000 Tutsis were being murdered in Rwanda, in the Congo. And by the way, the murder rate, they murdered nearly a million of them, murdered in less than 100 days, which incidentally is a faster rate than the Holocaust, much faster. It's approximately one person every 6 minutes was murdered. Do you understand? Since the birth of the State of Israel, there have been nearly 500 UN resolutions against the Jewish state. There's not been a single UN resolution against Rwanda or the Sudan. In fact, it was a few months ago that where the status of the Sudan was elevated in the United Nations. And Libya was the head of the Human Rights Commission at the UN. Now, you're laughing. It sounds like there's not a single person in this room who has an imagination that's fertile enough to even imagine to come up with this kind of stuff. This is Never Neverland. Yet you could not find an environment which is more hostile to Israel than particularly the written press, not only in Europe where you might expect it, not only in England where you would anticipate it, not only in France where you would say, well, this is consistent with the society, but in the United States there's only a handful of newspapers that simply get it right, that provide stories in context, that do not slander the children of Israel each and every day. Many people ask me the question, why? Why is the Philadelphia Inquirer so hostile to Israel? Why is Associated Press portray Israel in such a dark light, which we'll discuss in a moment? Why? Why is this going on? Why does Reuters need to present Israel in the way that it does? Why is that? This is all very strange. Incidentally, not only is it strange, it's happening at the strangest time. Those of you who have followed the way Israel is portrayed in the media know that this vicious assault really began its full richness that you see today, really only after Israel began to engage in the peace processes, be going back to Madrid and then Oslo and Camp David. Those of you who remember, those of you who have held Israel close to your heart all of your life, you know that if you went back to the 1970s, you would read the New York Times. It wasn't so vicious against Israel. It wasn't exactly, it wouldn't be like reading a newsletter from Hadassah. But it wasn't never the way it is today. Certainly, Europeans would not, the anti-Semitism in Europe, no one would have thought about it. We thought that maybe it must have been an anomaly, that maybe Europe bumped its head in 1930, something happened, it was a bad timing. Oh, any of you who know anything know that this was not going on in Europe back before. It's interesting, one would think that the more concessions Israel would offer, the more processes that Israel would engage in, if Israel would say, do you know that going back to the 1970s, Yossi Beilin, an arch leftist in Israel, when he was thrown out of the Labor Party, thrown out on his head because he advocated the notion of a Palestinian state. He was thrown out of Labor, not Likud. He wasn't thrown out of some national union. He was thrown out of the left-wing party for just advocating a Palestinian state. In the United States, if you work for the State Department and you were caught meeting with, talking to someone who was a member of the PLO, you were fired immediately, and it happened. In Israel, you were thrown in jail for it. Remember when the senator from New York, Hillary R. Clinton, when she advocated that it should be a Palestinian state going back years ago when she was first lady, people accused her of being an anti-Semite for suggesting there should be a Palestinian state. What happened? That means logically, as Israel changed and said, we're going to make more concessions, we're going to be willing to abandon Jewish land where Jewish people have been living. Jews have been living in Hebron for thousands of years. In fact, when King David, his first palace, his first royalty was in Hebron, it was only years later that it was moved to Yerushalayim. Hebron is an ancient Jewish community. Hebron was the center, was the headquarters for Chabad in the land of Israel. Going back, Hebron was also the center for great Jewish and there were four major yeshivot in Hebron before the Jewish state existed. Slobodka was there. Some of the great giant institutions of Torah learning were there. In August of 1929, the Haganah, which is the precursor to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, when the Haganah came to the Jewish community, very religious community, and certainly not Zionistic by any stretch of the imagination. These are not people who went into Zionism. They've been living there. They've been living with their Arab neighbors for centuries. When the Haganah intelligence came to the community and said, we're warning you, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, is now calling for a major slaughter in Hebron. Would you like us to come and defend you? We can bring our forces to Hebron to protect you from what we see to be as imminent, an imminent slaughter of the community. And the community had said, no, it's okay. We've been living with Arabs side by side for centuries. We've never had problems. We don't need it. If you're going to come here, you're going to inflame a situation which doesn't exist. And of course, many of you know here, it was a horrible Shabbos morning on August 24th, 1929, where marauds of Arabs with the support and help of the British came in. They slaughtered the entire Hebron Jewish community. Nearly 70 people were murdered. Hundreds and hundreds were maimed. The British either did nothing or collaborated with them. Every Jew had to leave Hebron, had to leave, run for their lives. So the fact that the Jewish state would now say, all right, Hebron was rendered Jew-free in 1929. And Jews, by the way, came back again, and they were thrown out again in 1936. So you think that Jews would say, Hebron, that's Jewish. Doesn't get more Jewish than Hebron. So you would think that with these concessions that were put on the table, there would be a greater love, even more love in the press. Because now Israel's willing to deal. It's willing to call Judea and Samaria a term like West Bank. Was also an anathema, which was shocking. To even consider 1 inch of liberating the land of Israel was considered unbelievable. But in fact, it's become worse and worse ever since these processes begun. Why did they do it? There are a lot of reasons for it. The number one reason that the environment of the media produces and nurtures a teaching of contempt and anti-Semitism. Just can be explained no other way. There's a great anti-Semitism that exists in the media. I don't have to explain that. And if somebody comes in who's not particularly inclined to be, antagonistic towards Israel, if you're a writer, ever wanted to be, it's not easy to get a job at a leading media giant, to be a writer, certainly, for the New York Times, for AP. It's something where there's one job for many people who are contending for it. And if you want to keep your job, you have to follow the culture of contempt that exists within these media giants. But the second reason is equally prevalent, and that is, in one word, access. Access means that if a writer, a journalist, decided that he was going to write something that was antagonistic towards the PLO, which is now known as the Palestinian Authority, that he will never get another interview in the PA areas, in the areas that are controlled by the PLO. If he writes something antagonistic, he has no access at all. We found out, it wasn't that long ago, that CNN had remained silent on the atrocities of Saddam. Why is it now we knowing really so much more about what the graves and the torture rooms and the rape rooms? Why didn't CNN publicize? They had enormous access within Iraq before the United States invaded Baghdad. And we found out the deal was there. As long as CNN decided to remain silent, they had full access to Saddam, full access to the Ba'ath Party. A famous case that came up recently was about the 1932 Pulitzer Prize winner, Walter Duranty. Walter Duranty worked for the New York Times. He said nothing about the famine from 1932 to 1933, where millions and millions of Ukrainians, their lives were destroyed. Nothing. And now the question was, it came up a few months ago, should his Pulitzer Prize be retroactively taken away from him because of his atrocities of remaining silent? Why was he silent? He remained silent so that he can have access to Stalin. He didn't have access to the Soviet Union. He said nothing about it. In fact, he said the opposite. He made it clear that things were doing well. People were doing, there was a little food shortage here or there, but essentially people, no one's going hungry. I remember a horrible morning. It was October 12th, going back to the year 2000. It's a story that all of you know. Two Israeli reservists made a horrible turn. They actually, right near our studios in Bet El, they made a very bad turn. And they went into Ramallah. And they were immediately arrested by PLO, PA policemen, taken into the police headquarters. Their bodies were ripped to pieces. They were murdered. Their eyes were gouged. They were disemboweled. They were thrown out of the window with their eye sockets burnt out. Most of you here have seen it. Their bodies were literally torn open and their intestines. You need to know this. You need to know what's been done. You need to hear. Their intestines were removed. The people, there was a crowd of thousands of people there. They lifted up the entrails of these two poor souls. And they screamed, Allah, and they put it in their mouth. You would have never known a thing of that ever happened. You certainly would never see the film of that atrocity had it not been for the RAI, which is the official Italian. There was one Italian cameraman who was there who happened to have filmed it, and for some reason he left with the film intact, and it shot around the world in the blink of an eye. And immediately the PLO said, you can't come anywhere near here. They put out a fatwa for the guy who did it. I have here this letter written by the RAI to the PLO the following day. Dear friends in Palestine, we congratulate you and think that it is our duty to put you in the picture of events of what happened on October 12th in Ramallah. One of the private Italian television stations which competes with us filmed the events. That station filmed the event. Afterward, Israeli television broadcast the pictures and was taken from the Italian stations. We emphasize to all of you that the events did not happen this way because we always respect the journalistic procedures with the Palestinian Authority for the work in Palestine, and we are credible in our precise work. Signed, Ricardo Cristiano. You want access, you can't write what's going on. You can talk about what's going on in Israel. You cannot speak about what's going on in the PLO. What I'd like to do with you in the time that we have together this evening is examine the techniques used by the media. We do not have the time tonight to examine each and every stunning, misleading piece of information put out in the world media. What I'd like to do with you in the little time that we have together is to examine the techniques and how information is manipulated by the media in order to smear the Jewish state and literally present the state of Israel as the greatest offender of human rights in the world. I hope that if you understand the basic techniques that are used, then you're going to be able to go home and do something. One day, your son's going to ask you a question. One day, your granddaughter is going to ask you a question. Savta, Daddy, when Jews were dying on the streets of Shmuel Hanovi, what did you do? You know, today you can walk from Kiryat Arba, which is a beautiful Jewish community of many thousands of people, to the Maris HaMachpelah, which is the tomb of the patriarchs. This is the second holiest place on earth. Stop. Little road. It's a 15-minute walk. Just pick up a clump of dirt. Just reach down, pick up a clump of earth in your hand, put it to your nose and smell it. It has a metallic odor to it. You can walk around Shar Yafo, you can go by Damascus Gate. Try it. Pick up a clump of dirt. You look at it, it has kind of a reddish hue to it. The reason why the land of Israel has such an odor is not because there's great minerals in the earth, as it is in many places like Sedona, Arizona, that create certain colors and certain odors. It's because the land is soaked with blood, Jewish blood. You take a walk in Yerushalayim, you walk a few steps, you should know that the reason that square meter exists for you to put your foot on is because the Moskowitz family lost two children. You drive up the land of Israel and you go past the Sea of Galilee, which is a lake, of course, and you, as you're going north and you look up to your right and you see the vast plateau, the Golan, that was used by the Syrians to murder our people as they planted and harvested in the demilitarized zones. So you can look at every step of the way. You see here, this was paid for by the Lefkowitz family. They literally, the boys, on the last few hours of the Six-Day War, they ran into the guns of the Syrians in order to liberate it. Last few hours. So one day, your children are going to ask you, I mean, look at you. I think you're all too young to have done anything during World War II. All of us have studied the Shoah. We all have. We all have looked back, and I was born in 1960. I don't look it, but I was. I was born 15 years after the Shoah came to a conclusion. Every one of you thought, what would have happened to me if I was alive then? Every Jew does. You were just off by a couple of generations. You would have just been born two generations earlier. You would have been right in the middle of things. If your grandfather had not made the decision in 1915 to emigrate to the United States and move to Philadelphia, you would have been there. If you would have existed at all. And every one of you have asked the question, what would I have done if I would have been alive then? What would I have done in 1939 when the St. Louis, packed with 1,000 desperate souls, came to the shores of the United States, Cuba, Canada, pleaded for a place to put their foot to escape Hitler's ovens? This country and so on sent them back to die, where most of them did. What would you have done? Would you have demonstrated in front of the White House? Would you have thrown your body down? Hard to answer. If you were in Poland as it was invaded, would you have fought in the resistance? Hard to say. Today, you're facing it now. Today, our people are dying. I say this to you, and I'm just talking between me and you. It's just us two, okay? Make sure that when your grandchildren ask you the question, Grandma, what did you do? Make sure you have an answer. God forbid that you should say, I remain silent. The first technique in the way that the media smears the Jewish state is really the most pervasive technique, and in a sense, it's their goal. When you use the term that's used very well by a woman named Joan Peters, book Time Immemorial, the term is called turnspeak. Let me give you her definition of turnspeak. It's the deliberate portrayal of the tormentor as a victim, turning things around, neutralizing the difference between good and evil. That's what it's about. The Israelis, they're oppressing the Palestinians who are innocent victims of this state which uses superior military and so on. Just undermining what is happening in the Holy Land. You'll hear the numbers going around about how many Jews have died since the recent Intifada, and you'll hear numbers like, 1,000 Jews have died, or 1,000 Israelis. Always the Israelis. It's not Israelis, it's Jews. They're not interested in Israelis. There hasn't been one single suicide bomber that went into a church in Israel filled with Christian Israeli citizens and blew them up. They have no checks outside. You go into a church filled with Israeli citizens. These are Christians, more than 100,000 in the land. Never have they been targeted for assassination. It's not about Israelis. It's about Jews. Ichbar al Yehudi means kill the Jews. Doesn't mean kill the Israelis. Britain's Tony Blair. For him, because there's no concept of right and wrong, good and evil, everything is equated. So when Tony Blair's announcement, upon hearing that Israel had assassinated the founder of Hamas,
we condemn the targeted assassination of Hamas leader Abdelaziz Rantizi, just as we condemn all terrorism, including that perpetrated by Hamas. We have to break out of this vicious cycle of suicide bombings and retaliation. Israel needs security. And the only lasting security will come from the stability of a solution to the Middle East peace process with two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace. The roadmap remains the best way to peace, and disengagement from occupied territory can be an opportunity to return to it. Disengagement is not the final step. It has to be an important first step on the road to a final settlement.
Abdul Aziz Rantisi, he's the person who was heir to the throne of Sheikh Yassin. Doctor, there seems to be this overwhelming number of physicians who are terrorists somehow. So if there are any doctors, you should check them 20 times. I don't know what it is. Like, you can't get into Hamas today if you're not a pediatrician or a gynecologist. You can't get into Al-Qaeda. First, you have to somehow graduate from some sort of medical school just to get into Al-Qaeda today. There's no, a dentist won't even get in. You have to something... Just a podiatrist, you can't join Hamas, there's no room for us. Hezbollah is the minimum, you have to have board certified to get into Hezbollah. To him, it was condemning what Israel has done by killing Rantisi exactly as it is to the people that Rantisi had murdered over the years. No distinguishing right and wrong, good and evil, doesn't exist for him. Now, you should know something interesting, and that is that although the paper media is vicious on Israel, there are some notable exceptions, obviously like the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, Canada's National Post, and others. Overall, especially the major papers in America, and certainly in Europe, it's an absolute disaster. News talk radio in the United States is quite the opposite. In generally speaking, the highest rated news talk radio shows in America are extremely pro-Israel. That's an area where we can breathe. That's an area where information can be presented in a way that's balanced, that's honest. Why is news talk radio tend to be conservative? Well, it sees itself to a large measure as almost a rebellion against the mainstream media. So you have people like Rush Limbaugh, whatever you think about his politics, man's deeply pro-Israel. You take a man like Sean Hannity, whatever you think about his politics, here's a nice Catholic boy who is a staunch Republican. I mean, he supports Bush and he wants to see Kerry go down. He devotes each and every show that I've heard to making sure that Bush is reelected for a second term. To demonstrate to you the extent of their honesty when it comes to Israel. Because many people say, some of these news talk radio show hosts, they're like too Republican. They're too, it just becomes ridiculous. They don't want to, he doesn't want to criticize Bush. The only time I've ever heard Sean criticize Bush openly with anger was when George W. Bush demanded that Israel stop attacking the terrorists in Ramallah when Israel went into Jenin. And went into Jenin, they could have carpet bombed Jenin the way the United States was carpet bombing in Afghanistan. And could have done it from a safe distance, thousands of feet up in the air. Pilot would have been completely protected. But many civilians would have died. And yet when Israel goes into Jenin and loses 23 soldiers, 13 in the blink of an eye, because they decide to go door to door in Jenin looking for the terrorists after the horrible Seder massacre, and they wanted to minimize civilian casualties, it was George W. Bush who stood at the Rose Garden and demanded that Sharon get out now. And it was Sean Hannity that said, that's wrong. Why is it that America would be doing this while Israel's not allowed to defend itself? I remember when Mahmoud Abbas, a Holocaust revisionist, former prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, when he became prime minister, so it was very important to move to advance the roadmap. And George W. Bush demanded, even though it was not in the roadmap, and most people consider the roadmap to be heavily tilted against the Jewish state, to be a disaster, to place Israel behind the green line of 1967, which means that if Israel would recede back to where Israel was on June 5th, 1967, the width of the state of Israel, by, let's say, a place like Netanya, would be 9 miles. Tel Aviv, 11 miles. Abi Ibn, the former Israeli statesman, hardly could be regarded as a right-winger. Referred to the Green Line as the Auschwitz lines. And Bush demanded of Israel, in order to bolster Mahmoud Abbas's standing among his fellow Palestinians, he demanded that Israel release more than 400 terrorists. The very people who the PLO was supposed to jail as part of the first stage of the roadmap. The roadmap states that the first thing the PA must do is dismantle the infrastructure terrorism and to disarm the terrorists and to arrest them. And George Bush demanded that Israel release hundreds of these people in order to bolster the standing of Mahmoud Abbas. And you can imagine that's what Sean Hannity screamed and said, this is immoral. So generally speaking, News Talk Radio is a very important medium in the United States. Generally speaking, News Talk Radio is very good news for Israel. But there's a notable exception. Does anyone know what that notable exception is? NPR, National Palestinian Radio. National Palestinian Radio, NPR, is a disaster. It's first of all extremely popular. It has roughly 22 million listeners weekly. NPR Radio is very particularly dangerous. So the reason why it's so dangerous is, generally speaking, the media services that are very credible are most dangerous to Israel. So if you have some, you know, the Kuwaiti Times publishing something that's anti-Israel, when Al Jazeera, you know, refers to Jewish soldiers, occupation forces, it has no impact on the way the Americans or Europeans think, because no one takes it seriously. But NPR, given A, number one, that it's a non-profit station, so non-profit, they have no, non-profit sounds like they have no, they, I should be so non-profit. You will, I bless you, you should be so non-profit like NPR, you'll be doing fantastic. NPR, none of that is perceived to be, and it is federally funded. When you know taxes are taken out of whatever you pay, 30%, 35% to 33%, whatever you're paying in taxes, a part of that goes to NPR. Part of it goes to the PLO. That's why Jews get into cash businesses. It's not for them. So the NPR has an enormous credibility, a very powerful standing, because it is perceived as federally funded. It's like a government thing. It must be honest. It must be true. It's even the way NPR, you know, you listen to NPR, it has this kind of very cerebral monotone, there's like a, just a mild little echo in there, very straightforward, you know, very even, nobody gets excited on NPR, just very straight away, you know, and Jews are going, oh yeah, brach, turn the channel, you know, but that kind of presentation, you know, not the shock radio, not like, you know, savage kind of stuff, but things that are just very, very even, sounds credible. These people are not excited about it, it's not emotional about it, they're thinking, and they're presenting, oh, it must be true. NPR is, without a question, therefore one of the most dangerous media sources. And in fact, I could do this whole presentation showing you each and every technique just using NPR. I'll just give you a taste of NPR radio, and it gives you a sense of where they're coming from. In fact, in this little piece, this audio piece, if you listen to it, you know who Scott Simon is. He's one of their most important journalists, one of their most important guys on the air. He's the voice you often hear on the air, certainly involved in the Middle East. And he does this interview with a guy named Richard Ben Kramer. Richard Ben Kramer, you should know who he is because he used to be the editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He won a Pulitzer Prize, viciously anti-Israel, and you could tell from his last name he's also Jewish. They love to use Jewish people when they do the interview because they want to inoculate themselves. They want to insulate themselves against the charge of anti-Semitism. When you go home, you go on the Guardian website, you know, the Guardian's a British paper, very credible, world-renowned, and just becoming more so over the years. And you look at the people on there, it says, you know, you ever look at the names on there, especially those in the Middle East? It's Matzkowitz and Ginsburg and Fletchkovich. And it's like a Borough Park phone book. You ever notice that? Why? Because they want to make sure that no one could accuse them of anti-Semitism. Look at the role of Jews. That's the main way it's done. This just happened a couple of weekends ago. It was astonishing. You know, Richard Ben Kramer just wrote a book called How Israel Lost, I believe is the title, the Four Questions, and it just tears apart Israel and so on. Vicious is not even the term for it. In the interview, here's a journalist literally turning to Ben Kramer. Is there a need anymore for a state of Israel?
Richard Ben Kramer has written a short book that tries to redefine one of the great consuming problems of the past 50 years, a dispute that's cost thousands of lives and seems to recede even further from any kind of resolution. His new book is How Israel Lost, The Four Questions, in which he tries to take up some of the great vexing issues of the past two generations between Israelis, Palestinians, and much of the rest of the world. But he won the Pulitzer Prize for his Middle East reporting in 1997 when he covered the region for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Mr. Kramer joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Now, you can tell, by the way, by where this is going to go very, very quickly. Because, as you can imagine, you have a guy like Simon and Kramer on together, it becomes a feeding fest on Israel. And you can hear just by the opening of Kramer, like, what influenced you to do this? Just listen to his answer of why. And then you imagine this, you're driving there on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, right? You got to make sure you have a very loud radar detector on, because you're driving, you hear a broadcast like this, and you hear just this first question and answer, and you know that Israel's in line. You know, you go out and say, you know what, honey, let's get the Kevlar first.
Let me throw one of your first questions to you right off. Why should Americans care at all about this?
Well, you know, over the years, the Israelis have convinced us somehow that they are like us, or even more, that they are us, or standing in for us. A bulwark of democracy and Western values in the Middle East. And what sent me out to do this book was suddenly I got the feeling that maybe they aren't like us, or maybe we don't want to be like them. So,
talk a bit about the differences between you when you covered the region in the late 70s and when you return now in the early part of the 21st century.
You know, if I had to sum up what I thought I knew after 7 years as a Middle East correspondent in and out of Israel 100 times, I would have called it a nice little socialist country with one problem. And the problem being, of course, its relations with the Arab world. But what I found when I went back this time was, number one, the country wasn't so little. The policies of annexation and settlement had made it a much bigger place. Place of superhighways. Number two, it was no longer a socialist country. While they cast themselves as America's little buddy, mostly during the Reagan years, they changed over to a very hard-edged capitalist system.
Now, get ready. Imagine Israel is a very large country. To give you a sense of Israel's size, Israel is roughly, the United States is nearly 700 times the size of the Jewish state. But if you have a superhighway, apparently that can't be the case at all. I mean, where would you put him? Where are you rushing to? And this piece, incidentally, I chose it for you because this is a Philadelphia audience, and this is very recent. This was just done a couple of weeks ago. And this back and forth is something I had never even heard in a European broadcast.
You were a kid who grew up putting coins in little paper slots to plant trees in Israel.
That's right. We had to bring dimes to plant pine trees in Israel.
When the idea of the country was to be a refuge for people who had fled not just the Holocaust, but centuries of oppression.
Right.
Is there still a need for the state of Israel?
I think there is a need, Scott, and the need is in the breasts of the people, where the fear never goes away. It's almost a national imperative that they fear, because without threats to Jews, without the need to protect Jews, then Zionism itself needs a new rationale. And that's more than most countries can think up for themselves.
Richard Ben Kramer, his new book, How Israel Lost, The Four Questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
You won't even hear an exchange like that on the BBC. That's a journalist. Is there a need for a Jewish state? You know, if you go back in history and you ask yourself, before 1948, what was the last country that had sovereignty in the Holy Land? Some people would say it must have been Palestine. If you ask that person, what was the name of a king of Palestine? His answer would be, I have no idea. What currency did Palestine use? Didn't exist. What language did they speak in this country? What was their flag? It did not exist. None of these things existed. If you go back before 1948, the last country to have sovereignty in there was the Jewish state in the year 70 that was destroyed by the Romans. People refer to the land of Israel as occupied territories. It was in the year 1900, there was a survey done, there was many surveys done of the land of Israel. In fact, Mark Twain, who wasn't particularly noted as a particular lover of Jews, it's a complicated issue there, so don't walk out of here thinking he was anti-Semitic. It's not the case at all. But he visited the Holy Land and wrote about it, and he walked through and there was nothing there, just a few Jews. And he wrote about it extensively. In 1900, there was a travel book done for the land of Israel, and it was done by Germans. It was a German travel book, which sometimes I read on air. In Jerusalem alone, there were, just to give you a number, a statistic, there were roughly 28,000 Jews who lived there. Roughly 7,000 Christians and 7,000 Muslims. Let's talk on Turnspeak. If you follow NPR and the way it presents, the idea again is to blame the victim for what happens, to present the victim as somehow he, she is the oppressor. And again, think of what example you have. There's so many. It can't help but thinking of Tali Hatul. May 2nd was the date that nearly 200,000 members of the Likud Central Committee were to vote whether Jews were to stay in Gaza or to be thrown out. There are roughly 8,000 Jews who live in Gaza, which is the southwestern strip of the Holy Land. And people think that Israel won this from the Palestinians, that somehow in 67 there was Palestine, and then came along to Israel, and they destroyed Palestine and supplanted it with the Jewish state. What's very telling is that the world does not care about a Palestinian state. This is all about a destruction of the Jewish state. From 1948 to 1967, if we're to believe what the New York Times wants us to believe, what the UN declares is the problem is, and the obstacle to peace is settlements in what's called the West Bank, meaning Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Why for those 19 years from 48 to 67, when the Arabs controlled these lands, did they not ask for? Why didn't these Palestinians request a Palestinian state? And even if they forgot to ask about it, why didn't the Egyptians or the Jordanians offer it? And the answer is they didn't care. It wasn't relevant. The point was that there can't be a Jewish presence there. Once the Jewish presence was removed from these lands, did anyone know what year the PLO was formed in? 1964. And you kind of wonder, PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in 1964, what exactly did the PLO want to liberate in 1964? If, after all, the problem is the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, one would think in 1964 there'd be no need for a PLO. And if, in fact, original Palestine was never a country. Palestine is simply a region. No more than Siberia is a country, Sahara is a country, the Ozarks are a country, simply a region of the world. You've got to wonder these points to yourself. What was that about? So listen to NPR in the Middle East. You know the name Julie McCarthy. On May 2nd, members of Likud Central Committee are to vote for if the Jews of Gaza are to be removed or to be able to remain. Remarkable thing. Why would they be asked to vote? Because they're the one who put Sharon in power. On that day, of course, the numbers were staggering. It was nearly a 21-point spread of, let's say, about 60% of Likud said that they voted against the referendum. But it was also a horrible day because it was on that day that it was in the morning that the Hatul family, namely Tali, she's a 34-year-old mother of four children, ranging from 2 to 11. She was 8 months pregnant. She had her four children, four daughters in the car. And two PLO terrorists came. They sprayed her car with machine gun bullets. They then came to the car itself. She jumped to protect her children. They literally unloaded an entire clip into her stomach. And then they proceeded to shoot each child to death, and then they simply opened up clip after clip. I spoke to one of the Zaka people who came. Zaka is an organization, highly regarded organization of devoutly religious Jews that seek to protect the integrity of those who die. They also now are also a rescue organization where they're the guys you see at the place of a pigua, of a terrorist attack, you know, usually with long payas and beard, and they're collecting a piece of a kidney off a stop sign. They're there sopping up the blood so it's buried properly. I was speaking to a Zaka fellow who was part of the team that had to attend to that site of the four girls and mother's murder. He told me that ordinarily, when terrorist kills people by shooting, so ordinarily his job is simple, because when someone is shot, God forbid, so there's a bullet, so you take the body, and the body is intact. He said that they were shot so many times by the terrorists, clearly long after they were dead, that there were body parts all over, exactly as though it was an explosion. It's very hard to take bodies and rip them to pieces and have them laying more than 40 meters apart, body parts, using a machine gun, to give you an extent of the damage. Yet it was NPR's Julie McCarthy who was able to present this in a way that somehow it was the settlers' fault for why this occurred.
The outcome was Sharon's biggest setback since taking office 3 years ago and cast doubt on the stability of his government. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The settlers rallied support, saying Israel was withdrawing under fire. But there was ample evidence yesterday to show that their continued presence in Gaza is provoking bloodshed. Israeli troops shot dead two Palestinian gunmen after the men ambushed a mother and her four small daughters outside the Gaza settlement of Gush Katif. The family was shot and killed on their way to the Israeli city of Ashkelon, where they intended to campaign against Ariel Sharon and his plan to uproot them from Gaza. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
It's the settlers' fault for why this family is murdered. It's the settlers who instigate the violence that brings this about, and the people who commit this crime are gunmen. We'll call this part misleading definitions and terminologies. Now, you know how it works. You use the right language, you use information in a way, it has an enormous impact on people. Who does the BBC refer to as a gunman? Who's a militant? Who's a terrorist? This kind of language is used all over. Ariel Sharon, he's called hawkish, right-wing, ultra-right-wing Israeli prime minister, right? Yasser Arafat is chairman Yasser Arafat. You read the New York Times, he loves to do this. Friedman does it all the time. Palestinian witnesses report Israeli army claims. Technically, they're both correct. The Israeli army does claim, well, and Palestinian who claim to be witnesses report. You will know that if you use the word report and they're witnesses, you know that's credible. If somebody claims something, he probably is as innocent as O.J. Simpson. You know, he claims to have not been there. He claims that he never killed his wife. But, of course, we know otherwise. That's the language. In the world media, depending on how you classify murderers, will depend on who the victim is. If the victim is not Jewish, they're likely to be referred to as terrorists. Jewish blood is cheap in the world media, and therefore, if the victim is of someone who's Jewish, they're likely to be called a militant. Militant, what does that mean, militant? You know, what do you mean, someone's militant? You know, did the resistance, you know, fighters in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, they were militants. They took up military arms and they fought against oppression. Militant is vague. It doesn't mean someone uses military equipment to gain their ends. It tells us nothing about their cause, just not who is the victim. Are they civilians? Are they people who are part of the combat in the theater of operation? Were they originally targeted? Is this clad? Nothing at all. It was very easy to do this because I went to BBC. BBC is one of the most egregious haters of the Jewish state. And it was just about a month ago that two BBC journalists were attacked in Saudi Arabia. You had one fellow, his name is Frank Gardner. He was injured. And Simon Cumbers, he was murdered. Because those are BBC people in Saudi Arabia, and they were attacked by Al-Qaeda. If it's BBC journalists who are killed, BBC doesn't seem to have a problem to know what terminology to use to refer to the perpetrators. This is Bridget Kendall's report.
Security correspondent seriously wounded and killed his cameraman, Simon Cumbers. Tony Blair had this response to it.
Our first thought, obviously, with the families of those that have been involved. But I think it's important that we recognise that day in, day out, this is a struggle against these terrorists who will kill innocent people, who will kill people who are involved in our democracy.
Frank Gardner was rushed to hospital for overnight surgery. Simon Cumbers probably died instantly. This seems to be the latest in a string of terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia.
There is a serious and chronic terrorist threat in this country, and the question we are asking ourselves now is whether that threat is now acute.
In the Saudi capital tonight, a BBC team has arrived to investigate. Frank Gardner remains in hospital in a critical but stable condition. He and Simon Cumbers, apparently victims of the very terrorism they went to Saudi Arabia to report on. Bridget Kendall, BBC News.
Bridget apparently doesn't have a problem, and the reporters that she is, the anchor people and all the folks there in London, had no problem at all distinguishing between terrorism and militants. These people clearly carried out these acts were terrorists. Tony Blair had no problem referring to them as terrorists. How did the BBC report on the murder of the Hatoul family?
It's been a day of violence, of course, where you are, David, hasn't it? With two Palestinians, the latest dead.
Yes, that's right. This has been a day of violence. Earlier today in the south of the Gaza Strip, an Israeli woman and her four daughters were shot dead by Palestinian militants. And at least two Palestinians are believed to have been killed.
The United States is fortunate to have, as I said, many wonderful news talk radio show hosts who are honest in the Middle East, who find this as revolting as you do. But there are some that are not, you know, and obviously they belong to the radical left. And as you think of what are the centers of left-wing politics in America, well, naturally you think of New York, and you certainly think of a place just, if you go straight down, I guess you go straight down 80, you know, come out the other end, where are you? Probably somewhere around San Francisco. And
about Madison, Wisconsin, in the middle.
Well, you obviously work for AAA. That's okay. No, just kidding. That's very impressive to me because I can get lost in the shower. I have no sense of direction. I'm impressed with sea turtles that somehow come out of the shell. They know right where the ocean is. I'm looking around. Who put an ocean over here? I have no idea. San Francisco, African-American radio show host. Why do I point out the fact that he's black? The reason is that there are some wonderful radio show hosts in America who are African-Americans and who are very conservative and very pro-Israel, and they've all been on my show. You know, Larry Elders and others. Well, not this guy. His name is Ray Turnoff. He addresses the issue when Sheikh Yassin was assassinated by Israeli forces. And to him, Sheikh Yassin is somebody in a wheelchair. He's an invalid in a wheelchair.
And let me go to Alan in Ronan Park. You're on KGO Reta Yafaro. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Has not Hamas declared war on the state of Israel and is dedicated to its destruction?
Why do you ask that question?
Why do you ask that question? You've just condemned killing Yassin. Isn't Israel at war with this guy? You don't be like killing Hitler during World War II. Why does this guy, who's fairly articulate, where does this come from?
Well, I'm saying if they're at war with this organization, which refuses to negotiate, why are they not justified in going after the people that are sending suicide bombers over there?
Well, do you think that this is going to help, or is this going to cause an inflammation of the situation to the point where even more people will die now?
Well, maybe they got to do something. I mean,
there are options, aren't there?
Listen to this option.
You really have to send a helicopter and fire three missiles into a wheelchair. Could you not simply arrest the fellow and?
There you go. Why didn't Israel think of that one, huh? There's a knee slapper right there.
Well, I think the best thing would be if the UN would.
Now, what he does is he actually cuts him off right there.
For some reason, somebody cut him off.
Ooh, I wonder how that could happen. How did that happen?
There are options. You don't have to, you just ask yourself, is killing the sheikh, is that going to...
He's the sheikh, he's an invalid, he's in a wheelchair, he's never a terrorist.
Enrage... with outrage, an outreach of that rage to the point where now more Israelis will die, more Palestinians will die.
Let's talk about more Israelis dying after Israel assassinated Sheikh Ghazin and Rantisi. The number of suicide bombings in Israel dropped remarkably. Just one more point about language is important. That's the term settler. This whole pro-Palestinian movement is born out of a racist ideology. Did anyone know where Sharon was born?
Maharal.
And roughly, where is that? Because most people might think it's... Yeah, he was born actually right outside of Tel Aviv. He essentially was born in, for a moment, if we can play the game, he was born in Palestine. Yasser Arafat, I didn't even know where he was born. He was born in Egypt. So somehow Yasser Arafat is a Palestinian, and Sharon is somehow doesn't qualify. The term settlement is designed to dehumanize. Whenever people commit atrocities against another, they must always dehumanize the victim. So it wasn't a pregnant mother.
Julie, can you tell us about the violence in Gaza today?
Yeah, the Israelis say they targeted a high-rise building where Hamas had been broadcasting what they called incitement against Israel. The airstrike seemed to be a direct response to the ambush earlier in the day of a pregnant settler and her four daughters. A Palestinian gunman attacked their car as it was leaving the settlement block of Gush Katif to go and campaign against Sharon's plan.
Thank you so much, Julie. NPR's Julie McCarthy in Jerusalem.
She's not a pregnant mother. She's a pregnant settler. What's that? Somehow it's not a person anymore. It's just a settler. It's a usurper. After all, what do you expect? If you rob someone of their land, what do you expect? Imbalanced reporting, and I'll just deal with one aspect of this. Imbalanced reporting means that the media does not want to present two sides of a real issue. They don't want to take two voices from two different sides to explain. But the problem is that you don't look very good if you don't have someone who's Jewish on the other side. You don't have a Jewish person there. You guys can't just have Arabs on. So what they'll do is they'll take a guy like Michael Lerner, also known as Rabbi Michael Lerner, the head of Tikkun magazine, you know, and they'll say, here's Rabbi Michael Lerner. Now, Rabbi Michael Lerner is more anti-Israel than Yasser Arafat, okay? This is not radical left. This is so left, it's like fell over the other edge. This guy is essentially in the same genre as the Noam Chomsky's and the Norman Finkelsteins. When you call him rabbi, when he comes on, you can always tell when they're radical leftists that try to present themselves Jewish because, you know, they come onto these college campuses and they have a yarmulke roughly the size of an army regulation parachute. And, you know, to get that big, you know, it's something, you know, they have daisies hanging down there. NPR, the way they do it is they bring in certain Jews to play the other side. Michael Lerner is very important. And imagine a fellow living in western Pennsylvania, you know, or the other end of Interstate 80. He has no clue what's going on. He hears a rabbi speak. They put on a guy. His name is Akiva Eldar. Akiva Eldar, if you listen to NPR, you know that name. He's on constantly. Akiva Eldar works for Israel's most left-wing newspaper, the Haaretz. But in Haaretz, he's regarded as the most left-wing reporter. He is, way over the edge, you know. Akiva Eldar, by the way, is often condemned by the left for being too left-wing. I'm not kidding. And I'll explain this. He has failed what leftists refer to as the Lynch test. Failed the Lynch test. What does the failed the Lynch test mean? And that is that when those two Israeli reservists were murdered in Ramallah and their bodies were ripped to pieces, the left condemned it. Only he blamed Israel for it. So to give you a sense of Akiv Eldar, if the NPR is going to interview somebody and they want to naturally make it something from Israel's position, from Israel's point of view, but they want it to remain completely ridiculously unbalanced, I mean, do you understand the impact that this has on listeners to NPR?
Akiva Eldar is a political columnist for the newspaper Haaretz in Israel. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And what's your feeling, Mr. Eldar? Would Yasser Arafat in exile be stronger, more sympathetic internationally than Yasser Arafat in Ramallah?
No, I don't think so. And the problem is not really Arafat. If he's in Ramallah or in Tunis or in Cairo, The question is if you're going to get a better Arafat, someone that will be more sympathetic to the idea of the Israeli occupation. Mm-hmm. I think it's too easy for some people in Israel to believe that it all starts and ends with Arafat, and I'm afraid that the morning after they wake up without Arafat, they're going to miss him because there will be no one else to blame it on, and things are not going to get any better.
This is an Israeli reporter, after all. Okay. I'm going to finish off with the last technique that is used, and I'm going to turn this over to you for questions. Distortion of facts. There are countless examples I could have used, and I wanted to use the example that really launched pro-Israel activism to fight against the media. The date was September 30th, the year 2000. You can only imagine what it was like for a Chicago Jewish man, a religious man, to pick up the paper, see a photograph, Associated Press photograph, and it says here, an Israeli policeman and a Palestinian on the Temple Mount. And in the photograph, you have a very clearly a very angry, big Israeli policeman, and you have a young Palestinian, his head beaten in, blood, although, you know. Now, imagine when you're looking at this and say, boy, look what that happened to that Palestinian boy. And then you're going, my gosh, that's my boy, that's my son. You know, you can imagine his shock to find out that this Palestinian was, in fact, Tovia Grossman, his own son. And there's a reason why I'm bringing this up, because it's such a startling distortion of facts. Associated Press was sued and brought to court as a result of this in France, in Paris, in April 2002, because of a lot of activism. That's what I want to explain that you need to do. Because of a lot of work, Associated Press had to pay 4,500 euro because of what they had done. The New York Times was made aware of the fact that this photograph was, in fact, a Jewish boy. What makes this so ridiculous is what occurred here. You have this Tovia Grossman, a 20-year-old yeshiva student from Chicago studying in Jerusalem. This didn't happen on the Temple Mount. Those of you who even have a superficial knowledge of what the Temple Mount looks like, if you look carefully at the photograph, you'll see here there's a gas station. Now, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Temple Mount and what's there, but one of the things that are not on the Temple Mount is a gas station. There's no gas station. Moreover, this gas station has Hebrew lettering on it, so you're on the Temple Mount. I'm not sure. I don't think that the WAFC would appreciate a Jewish guess. New York Times is made aware of it. They put in their corrections the next day. Really, it was Tovia Grossman was Jewish. He wasn't a Palestinian boy. But you know what happens? People like yourselves who care about Zion, who really want to make a difference, they press it. And the New York Times would finally print it again, print the whole photograph with an explanation and explain this was a Jewish boy. Absolutely shocking is that this young boy, Tovia Grossman, continues to be the object of pro-Palestinian movement. In fact, I took this last night from the front page of the website of the Egyptian Department of Tourism, and on the front page they want to say Mubarak on international terrorism. And if this is still on the website, and if you go there, it's on their front page, you see in their photo album, there's the same pictures. He's still up there. This is going around all over the Arab world. Now, what this is it says here, drink Coca-Cola, support Israel. By supporting American products, you're supporting Israel. And they're still using Tovia Grossman throughout the Arab world. This is their poster. I want to read to you this letter that was written by Dr. Martin Luther King in August of 1967. Dr. King, may his memory be a blessing to us, as one of the great civil rights leaders. They don't produce him like that anymore. I think the thinking goes, my gosh, we really need you today. Dr. King had to deal with people in his own ranks, people he worked with, who were terribly anti-Israel, but they claimed they weren't anti-Jewish. They were just anti-Zionist, but they had no problem with Jews, which is Zion. You declare, my friend, that you do not hate the Jews. You are merely anti-Zionist. And I say, let the truth ring forth from the high mountaintops. Let it echo through the valley of God's green earth. When people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. This is God's own truth. The Negro people, my friend, know what it is to suffer the torment of tyranny under rulers not of our choosing. Our brothers in Africa have begged, pleaded, requested, demanded the recognition and realization of our inborn right to live in peace under our own sovereignty in our own country. How easy it should be for anyone who holds dear this inalienable right of all mankind to understand and support the right of the Jewish people to live in their ancient land of Israel. Let my words echo in the depths of your soul. When people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. Make no mistake about it. Thank you and good night.